All right, welcome to Computer Science 50 Super Section. Today we're going to cover JavaScript and Ajax before we do our walkthrough tomorrow at 4:30 here on Problem 8, which involves using JavaScript and Ajax. So why I did this super section is because I thought that the coverage in lecture and normal sections wasn't enough to do the problem set, and I didn't want people to be confused during the walkthrough, so that's why I'm doing the super section today. Okay, so any questions before we begin? Anything at all? No, okay. So we'll start with what topics we're gonna cover today. As you might expect, we're gonna cover JavaScript. This is the client-side language that we've been using to create our web applications. We're gonna cover the key language features, the syntax of JavaScript, as well as the DOM, the document object model. We'll see what that is all about, and Ajax. Using XML HTTP request. So we'll cover all these today in our section. And if you have any questions, please do feel free to stop me. Although this session is videotaped, it's still supposed to be a section, so please do feel free to ask me questions. Okay, so the first thing about JavaScript, as I mentioned, that it's a client-side programming language. Unlike PHP, which executes on the server, everything that you write in JavaScript executes on the browser. So if the users are using Internet Explorer or they're using Firefox, the JavaScript and the version of JavaScript that they use depends on the browser itself and not on the server. So in PHP, we use those PHP blocks to denote blocks of PHP code in our .php files, but in JavaScript, instead of creating our own special .php kind of files, we create our JavaScript script blocks inside these script tags in our XHTML pages. So there are three ways of embedding JavaScript in our pages. One of them is to use script tags. So let me pull up this example here. In example 1.html, I've shown here three ways of, well, not really three, but two ways of using JavaScript. Here in the head element, we have some JavaScript. It's a JavaScript comment that says some JavaScript here in the head. Then we also have this second block in the body tag in lines 16 to 20, which is also identical to the head tag, but also contains some JavaScript. And then we also have this line on line 13, which seems to reference an external file, script type text JavaScript source src equals some external JavaScript.js. So it seems like we can do two things. We can embed the JavaScript in our files, just as we did with PHP, and we can also call external files that contain JavaScript. Okay. So if we take a look at the first block from line 7 to 11, we have this C data thing. Does anyone know what this is? Any guesses? Okay, so if you've done any JavaScript programming at all in the past, you may have come into comments, HTML comments with the open angle brackets, bang, hyphen, hyphen, and then hyphen, hyphen, close, angle brackets. So that was a way to hide JavaScript from older browsers which didn't support JavaScript because back in those days, there used to be browsers that don't support JavaScript at all and would simply print out the code in your HTML page if you encountered a page with JavaScript. So that was a way of hiding stuff. And this is very similar, but it has a different purpose. So if you've been doing problems at 7, you'll have validated your pages using the W3C validator, validator.w3.org. And when you feed in an XHTML document like this into a validator, since it's passing the document as an XHTML page, it's going to encounter some characters in JavaScript and complain, and it will say that it's not valid JavaScript. Valid XHTML. But by putting these JavaScript blocks in these C data sections, which are some specially defined sections in XHTML and XML itself, you can effectively hide that JavaScript code from the validator. So this is what we do. We have to put these in JavaScript comments because we don't want the JavaScript interpreter to think that they're part of the JavaScript. So first we comment them out, and then we start the C data section. Okay? So think of this as a formula. It's a magic part of code that you have to write, and it's not something that needs to be changed all that often. OK? Okay, so any questions about that so far? No. Okay, so, and there's, when you define an external JavaScript file, for example, this some-external-javascript.js, you don't need to put the script tags inside the JS file. Okay, so that's a common mistake. If you're reading in a JavaScript file externally using this script circ attribute, then inside the .js file, you don't need the script tags. Good? Okay, so, and also one more thing. If you've been following the XHTML tags, you'll have noticed that you can so there's shorthand for closing tags. For example, br, you could write with br then forward slash to say open br then close br. So that's shorthand for opening a tag and closing a tag in XHTML. But if you do the same for script, so for example, if I went ahead and typed script like that, you'd think it would work, right? Because it's opening the tag and closing the tag. It's simply shorthand. But in fact, it doesn't work in some browsers. I believe it doesn't work in Firefox, or it's not a good idea to do that. So always put in these the end script tag, even though it seems as if it's unnecessary. Okay. All right. So that was just how to embed JavaScript in your pages. Any questions there? No. Okay. So go back to the slides. So the first thing about JavaScript is variables. So just like in C, just like in PHP, we have variables in JavaScript. So there are two types of variables. There are global variables and local variables. This is very similar to C, where you had so variables that you defined within functions were local variables, and they were outside of the scope of the function if you try to call them from outside. Whereas functions that you defined at the variables that you defined at the top of the source code file would be available anywhere and in any function, right? It's the same thing with JavaScript. Global variables you simply define as is, CS equals 50. That's defining an integer. So one thing about JavaScript is that it's loosely typed. There are no types in JavaScript, or at least the types are very flexible, as in PHP. So here we're defining an integer CS with the value 50, and that's going to be a global variable. Okay, and when we define a local variable, we put var at the beginning, and that denotes a local variable. So it's only available within the scope of the function that created it. Okay. Next, we have arrays, and this is very similar to PHP arrays. So just like in PHP, JavaScript arrays can contain anything. They can contain integers. They can contain strings, floats, other arrays, objects, as we'll see. So arrays are very flexible in JavaScript, and they're very useful. So you can initialize an array in several different ways. One way is to say tfs equals, if tfs is an array, brackets, and then close brackets. That will initialize a completely new empty array. Okay. So can anyone tell me if this is a local or global array that I've just allocated? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's global. It's global because there is no var at the front of the tfs declaration. Okay, so the next one, tfs equals new array. So this is, you might have seen this in PHP when you're using classes, and you'll see this in C++ and many other languages that we have today. Basically, we're just creating a new instance of an array, because an array is an object in JavaScript. It's a type of object. So we're basically mallocing some space for an array, although it's not exactly malloc. So it does the same thing as the first line. Okay, it's just an alternative way to do the first line. And then the third line, which is more interesting, says tfs equals brackets. So brackets denotes an array. And then 1, so presumably the 0th element of the array is now the integer 1. And then the second element is 2. So here we see that we can actually mix types in an array. So we don't need to stick with a particular type as we do in C in an array. And then the third element in the array. What is this? Can anyone tell me what this might be? This third element?
It's just a function.
Mm-hmm. It's just a function, yeah. So what is a function doing in an array? Have we seen this in C or in PHP? It seems sort of strange, right? I mean, a function is a function. It's not supposed to be a variable. But the thing is, in JavaScript, a function is a variable. It's a first-class object, meaning that it can be created on demand, and it can be assigned to things, and it can be put in arrays like this. Okay, so we'll see how this can be useful later on, especially using Ajax and many other APIs that require something like this. So does everyone understand what this third line is doing? Why we have these three separate types in our array? Good. Okay, so that's initializing arrays and putting elements inside them. The second section that I have here is referencing arrays. This is pretty self-explanatory. It's the same as PHP. So TF2. What is the value of TF2? TF2 is... Sorry about that. I don't know what happened. So TF0 is 1. So it's 0-based. So TF2 is the function. Yeah. So TF2 would return the function, function return 3. Okay? So that's how we refer to arrays. And then we can also iterate through arrays. Has anyone used the for each construct in PHP? It's one word for each. It's very useful if you have an array and you're trying to iterate through all of the elements. You can look that up in the PHP manual. There's something very similar in JavaScript. And instead of saying for int I equals 0, blah, 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 like we would do in C, we can say for var I in TFs. So what we're doing is iterating through each of the elements in TFs, assigning the index of each element to I. And I is a local variable, as we can see with the var word. And then we're saying alert, oh, I found a something. TF's I would be the current element that we're referring to. Okay? Yep.
What if you wanted to start in the middle of the array, like not from the beginning?
Mm-hmm. So what if you wanted to start it from the beginning of the array? So in that case, you would probably want to do a normal for I equals 0, I smaller than equals 2. Okay? Any more questions? Okay, so I'll show you what this actually looks like in the browser. So example 2.html. So it's already executed. So I defined TFs to be, as you can see from the PowerPoint, Example 2.html, this is how I defined my TFs array. I defined TFs to be an array of three strings. So I didn't use the new array construct, but I used the square brackets. And then I've used the for var index in TFs loop here. And then I've used the alert function. So what is the alert function? I already sort of gave it away by showing you the browser screen, but it shows a message to the user. And it can be really annoying if you're popping up lots of alerts to the user, so it's best to use it judiciously. So this is going to say, oh, I found A, and each of the TF's names will appear here. Okay. So one thing that we can notice is that you concatenate strings in JavaScript using the plus operator, okay? Not using the dot operator like in PHP, but the plus operator like in Java, okay? Well, does Java use dot or plus? I forget. Does anyone know? I don't know. Okay. we'll go back to the browser window. And then we have our first iteration of the for loop. I found a David. And then what do you expect? Oh, I found a Jansu. Oh, I found a Glenn. Okay? So we can see that the code is actually running. And as you can see here, there's actually no output to the screen. Okay? That's because the HTML, there was no HTML itself in the document, just the script tag within the body tag. So one thing about JavaScript is that if you put a script block inside the body tag, then it will execute immediately upon page load. Okay, and it's the same if you put it in the head element. So one distinction that you can make between the head element and the body element is that if you're trying to initialize something and it has no direct relation to events that the user has created, like clicking a button, then it's often a good idea to put it in the head element. There's often not really a good idea. So you might want to put your script tags in the body tag if you're writing something out to the page. Okay, so if you have a specific part of the page that you want to write something to, then you might want to put a script tag there. Okay, but in most cases, you should put the script tag in the head element. And for problem set A, that's what you should do too. Okay, any questions? All right, so we'll go on to more interesting stuff. Switch statements. Right. Switch statements. So we already saw. So JavaScript supports the if else statements, as in C. It also supports switch statements like C and PHP, but it's much more flexible than in C. So in C, you saw that you couldn't use switch statements with strings. Because you can't compare two strings in C without using the strcomp function. But in JavaScript, since you can compare strings using the equals equals operator, you can also use the switch statement to switch between several strings or integers or any type. So we can see here that we have some var, which is some kind of variable. We don't know its type. It might be an int, it might be a string, it might be an object. But depending on the what sumvar is, if it's the string hello, it will say document.write, oh, hello. Document.write is a very useful function that part of the DOM, as we'll discover later. And basically what it does is write something to the document at that position. So you can imagine having this JavaScript as part of a script tag that's within the body tag. Okay, and it'll write it there. So it's like a printf statement. And then we have case 42. So if some var happens to be 42, an integer, then it'll show an alert message. And then if it's neither the string hello nor the integer 42, then it'll say variable is plus some var. So there are two things that we can notice from this. So strings can either be double quoted, as in the document.write statement, or single quoted, as in the switch statement. That's just like in PHP, but unlike PHP, which does actually have a distinction between single-quoted strings and double-quoted strings, in JavaScript, it doesn't really matter whether you use single quotes or double quotes. Okay, they mean the same thing. And it's useful that it has two of those because HTML attributes themselves have double quotes and single quotes, and when you're using events, you want to use the other one so you don't confuse the XHTML interpreter. And one more thing that you can notice is that since JavaScript is loosely typed, you don't need to cast or do any of that fancy stuff with JavaScript. You can just say variable is some var, and whether it's an integer or whether it's a string, it'll just print out what you want it to print. Okay? Any questions? All right. This is a little bit more interesting. Functions. So just like in PHP, we have functions that are defined like so, function myfunc, and then return true or false, or return whatever you want, okay? And now we have a different function here, myfunc. It takes one variable, I, and then it says hello world. But instead of returning true or false, what is it returning here? It seems to be a function in a function. What is it gonna do? Why on earth would we want to do this? Yep.
It adds 2 to the variable that's passed to it.
Yeah, so it adds 2 to the variable that it was passed to it. So this function, when you specify, say, myfunc2, it'll return a function that... So I is the same I as in the function declaration at the top, I. So if we specify 2 as I, then it'll do return 2 plus j, which is 2. 2 plus 2, 4. So basically, this function will return a function that returns 4. Okay. So instead of returning 4 itself, it's going to return another function. And this type of function, where we have no name for the function, open parentheses, close parentheses, this is called a lambda function. And it can be a nice way to program. It can be very useful. It can be very confusing. But if you're interested, CS51 is all about functional programming, so you might be interested next semester. anyway, it's very it's often quite useful in JavaScript to do this because so you might have a say you might want to specify a function and then send that to some API, some external code that that you've linked to, and then that code will use that function in some way to give you back some data. Okay. So we see that Google Maps actually uses this, and Ajax itself uses this to do some functionality that would to create some functionality that would have been hard or impossible to do without these kinds of functions. Okay. Is everyone confused or no? Okay. So, and one more note: this is called a closure when you specify some data outside and it's used inside. That's just a technical note, but it's called a closure if you're interested in that. Okay, so we'll see how this is actually used in the upcoming slides. So here we have objects. So we've initialized an object. What is an object, first of all? An object is like a class in PHP. It's also very much like an array, and sometimes you can't tell the difference between the two in JavaScript. So first, what I've done here is to initialize a new object called car. Car equals new object. So basically what car now is it's an empty class or struct, just like you would do in PHP or C. Okay? So it's an empty container of things, of stuff that it doesn't have right now. And then we can add some things to the car object. Car.color equals the string red. That's one way to do it. And we can also use the array syntax, car year equals 2008. Okay? So that's a key called called year in the car object. So if you didn't know that car was an object, you couldn't tell whether it was an object or an array, right? So that's what I mean by it's sometimes difficult to tell whether something is an object or an array, because basically they are the same thing in JavaScript. Okay. So car year equals 2008, and then car dot make sound equals room. Room is a function that we've defined somewhere up there. And we're defining a variable to be a function. So this is new, right? We haven't seen this in C or in PHP. So what this means is that you can create a function and then define a variable to be that function on the fly. So you don't need to hard code this in. You can simply specify random functions to be in a variable. So this is similar to function pointers in C, which you may or may not have used. But basically what it does is that it creates a function and then puts it inside the object so that it belongs inside the object. Okay? And once you've done this, once you've done the last line of code, you can actually call room by saying car.makeSound. Okay? So makeSound was, as we saw here, makeSound was a variable, but we can actually call that variable. And calling car.makeSound will call the function that it's assigned to, room, so it'll call room. Okay? Does everyone understand? This is very important. Yep. Okay. So that's assigning functions to variables, and that's about it for syntax for now. And if you're confused or if you want to review, then you can also take a look at the section notes that are on the course website. Okay, so JavaScript gets interesting when we're not just talking about syntax, but when we're actually interacting with the browser. Because the reason why JavaScript was created was because it provides a dynamic framework for programming within the browser window. So if you didn't have JavaScript, then your browser pages would essentially be static. You might have the odd animated GIF, but if you didn't have JavaScript, then your pages wouldn't move. You could click buttons and you could submit, but you wouldn't be able to do anything else. No Gmail, no Flickr, no none of that fancy stuff. So JavaScript is what provides some life to web pages, and it's very interesting and useful when it's used together with the browser. So there's one the first step that you might take in JavaScript and browsers is the event attributes. So you might have seen the lecture examples and other web pages, if you've been looking at them, there are some attributes in XHTML that are defined for pretty much every visible tag. So, for example, a button might have an on-click event, an on-focus event, an on-blur event, on-key-down, on key up, on key press. These are all events that are triggered when a user does some kind of action. So for example, on click, obviously it's when a user clicks on something, on that thing. On focus is when the user focuses on that element, when he or she clicks on that element or taps into it. And on blur is the opposite of that. And on key down is when the user presses a key down on it, on the element. And on key up is when the user releases that button. And on key press is the two of those combined. Okay? So those are some events that that are defined in the XHTML tags. And we'll actually see what this means for us in example 3. Okay, so we have this code here, example 3. Let's see. So it's very it's a very simple page. It's just an XHTML document with a single div with an onClick attribute. OnClick equals alert, oh hi. So what do you think this does?
Click on it, and suddenly
the thing, the exclamation pops up and goes, oh hi. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you click on the div somewhere, and then an exclamation dialog pops up saying, oh hi. Great, okay, so we'll see if it actually does that. Hopefully it does. Example3.html. So click me. This isn't a button or anything. It's just a div. And then I click it, and it pops up that button. Okay? So what is this code doing? There's this onClick attribute, which, as I said, defines some kind of event that occurs when the user clicks on the div. And then within those double quotes, which are XHTML double quotes, we have alert, oh hi. We have some JavaScript source code. Okay, so this is the other way, the third way that you can embed JavaScript in your pages. Instead of using a script block, you can actually write any kind of JavaScript you want here. So for example, you can concatenate multiple lines with a semicolon and say, you know, I equals 0 for I equals 0, blah, blah, blah. So it can get very messy, but it's possible to type any kind of JavaScript statement inside that onClick event handler and any other event handler that XHTML has. Okay? Good. All right. So that's the onClick attribute and a simple example of using that in your XHTML pages. So we have this other thing here, the document object model. That's just a fancy way of saying that every element inside a browser window is represented inside this tree called a DOM. Okay? So there's a hierarchy of elements starting from the HTML tag, and then the body element, and all the elements inside it. And each element is called a node. Okay, so this is akin to XML and other tree-like data structures that we've been looking at. So you can maybe think of it as a tree or some kind of tree that represents the entire browser window. And each of those nodes, so each of those tags, has a number of attributes. So for example, it might have an onClick attribute, it might have a style attribute, and as we'll see later, it also has several hundred other attributes that you can manipulate at will using JavaScript. Okay, so that what does that mean? It means that you can actually modify your browser page on the fly. So you can add elements to it, you can delete elements, you can change the color of elements, you can move things around, and you can do anything you want with the browser window. So you're not limited to the XHTML code that you originally printed out, but you can actually start modifying that on the fly if you use JavaScript and the document object model. Okay? So that's how Google Maps manages to display its maps. Instead of refreshing to a new page when you try to move south or west or north or east, it will. So if you click on one of those links that, or rather with Google Maps, you can just drag the map. When you drag the map, instead of refreshing and going to a new page, it'll actually just change the browser window on the fly, so you don't see the window blinking or anything. Okay, so that's the cool thing about DOM, and we'll see what the DOM actually contains. So the document object contains all of those elements and attributes, as I said. And it contains get element by ID. Does anyone remember that from lecture, what it does?
You get whatever's in, say the element is called quote, and then mm-hmm. you get whatever is in quote mm-hmm. by calling quote inside those parentheses.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So get element by ID, so if you call something So if you give something an attribute ID of something, ID is like the name attribute that was used prior to ID, but ID is the name of an object. And if you put that within the single quotes, so get element by ID, single quotes, the name of that, the ID of that object, then you can retrieve that object magically from the DOM. So you'd usually call document.getElementById because it's one of the functions defined within the document object, which is a magical object that's created for every web page that represents the entire document. Okay? So, yeah.
When you say every element, do you mean everything between two HTML tags?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what
element is. Oh, so by element, I mean every element, as in, so for example, the body element is an element. So
okay.
Everything between body and body.
Okay, and within body there would be like quote, and that would be everything
within
quote.
Yeah, so everything within the body tags and every element within it is also a node and an element inside the DOM.
Okay.
So we'll see what that actually means by, there's this very neat web page that I like to use. So this is this just represents the JavaScript DOM as a tree, and as we can see here, we start off with the window element. Can everyone see this, or is it too small? Okay, so we start with the window doc object, which is an object that represents the entire window, the browser window, and then we have the document object, which is very useful. And as we saw, there is the get element by ID function defined within the object. Let's see if we can find it. Get element by ID. And the cool thing about this web page is that when you click on it, it tells you exactly what get element by ID is. So it says here that get element by ID is it returns a reference to an element in a DOM compatible browser. And a DOM compatible browser is pretty much any modern web browser out there. So basically, document represents the document within the window. And you can see here that there are several event handlers that are defined: on click, on double click, on key down, on key press, on mouse down, on mouse move, etc., etc. And there are so many other properties and methods that are defined within the DOM. Okay. So if you're interested, this will be. I'll put it on the course's resources page. It's a useful guide to the DOM. So if we go back to the slide, we talked about get element by ID, how you can retrieve an object using the document.getElementById function, and then you can call any function that's defined for that object on the return result of get element by ID. We'll see what that actually means in the next example. And then there's also the value attribute, which is for every form tag that has a value, for example, an input tag that takes some text, the input element dot value will return the value of that element. So the value that's currently been typed in by the user, or the value that was originally set by you. And inner HTML is also very useful. It defines the HTML that's within the tag itself. So if it's a div tag, then the div tag element dot inner HTML will return what's within what's between the open and closed tags of the div element. Okay. Get elements by tag name. We saw that in lecture today. That returns an array of all the elements that are the children of that object, which are named tag name. So, for example, if I call document.getElementsByTagName div, then I would get all the div elements that are defined within that document. Okay, so it transcends the barriers between children. So if you have a div and then a div within it, both of those objects will be returned by getElementsByTagName. Yep.
Different between getElementById and getElementById.
Okay, so get element by ID returns an object whose ID matches, and an ID is unique to the entire page.
Okay,
and get elements by tag name. So body is a tag name, div is a tag name. So these are completely separate from IDs.
Okay,
so IDs refer to instances of those tags, and tag name refers to the actual tag names of those elements. Good question. Okay, so we have an example called, what did I call it? Example5.html. Let's see. All right, so this is an example on using document.getElementById. Show you what it actually looks like first. Example. So get example 5. All right, so this is example 5. Let's see. Okay, wait, sorry. So first let's take a look at example 4, which is very similar to example 5, but is a little different. So here we have an input tag that has that says type something, and it doesn't have anything else, no buttons, nothing to press, so it looks like it uses JavaScript. And when I type something, for example, it turns red with every key press and turns back to white when I release the button. So what events am I using here? I'm using two events. What are they? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so on key down and on key up. So it turns red when it on key downs, and it turns back white when it on key ups. So let's see how this is actually implemented. So I have an input tag here. Input type text, ID text input. So here I've defined an ID here. So this is called a text input. And remember that this name is unique to the entire page, so we can't have another input tag named text input. And then I have on key down, flash me this. On key up, unflash me this. And then the rest is just XHTML. So what is this? Well, Notepad++ has conveniently highlighted the function for me. It's defined here as a function, and it takes one variable, the object. Okay. So this is actually a special object in JavaScript, whereby we're in the input element here, right? We're in the input element named text input right here, right? So we're in an object. And when we're inside an object, we can refer to that object as this. So instead of specifying document.getElementById text input, we can simply say this, okay? Since we're already inside this tag, we know what we're referring to when we say this. So flash me this actually sends a reference to that object, sends a reference to this input element to the function. Okay? Does everyone get it? Yeah? So when I call the flash me function in line 12, the object is populated with a reference to this input element. So can you see how the DOM makes every tag into an object, and how this is the object representing this input tag? Yeah. Okay. So I'm calling this. I'm sending this to flash me, and we can see here that I'm referring to the object, which is currently set to the input element. The object.style.backgroundColor equals red. So one neat thing about the DOM is that it allows you to manipulate CSS styles at will. So the object.style, style is an object that represents the CSS rules for that entire object. And background color, as the name suggests, is the background color for the object. And the same thing for style.color. Color is the CSS rule for the font color. Color equals white. Okay, so if you're trying to convert some CSS rule name to JavaScript, then simply remove the hyphens and convert that into camel case, which is for example, the capital C instead of hyphen C, background hyphen color in CSS is background big C color in JavaScript. Okay, and if you want to look this up, then the JavaScript tree webpage that I just showed a couple of moments ago also shows you what the actual style names are. So what am I doing here? In the flash me function, I'm simply changing the background color and the color of the object, this object, via JavaScript and DOM. Okay? Any questions? No? Okay, so, and one more thing, on key up is doing the same thing, but it's not as interesting, of course, because it's the same thing. All right. And also, if you have Firefox, you can download an extension called called Firebug, which is a JavaScript debugger, a CSS Ajax debugger, which will show you what's happening in the browser right now. I think it's cooler than the one that David likes to use. He also likes to use Firebug. So if I click on Firebug, if I click on my icon here after I've installed the extension, then I see this this panel, which acts as a debugger. So for example, let's say I want to inspect the DOM and see what's inside it. I can click on Inspect. Then I can go to DOM. Then I can see exactly what's inside the DOM. So let's see what's there. See if we can. Okay, document. So let's see if we can find the document object within the DOM. Let's see. Okay, so it's currently highlighted window HTML. So let's see if we can go to window.document. So document is an object here. Document, and then if we scroll down, we can probably find, for example, document.title, which is the title of this this page. Sorry, went to the script. Okay, so document.title here. So as you'll see later, if you try experimenting with this, document.title is actually a variable that represents the current title of the window. So you can actually change the title programmatically. So that's how the At College webmail system does those annoying flashing, you have new mail, window title things. Okay? So that's document.title. And as you can see here, it's currently set to using on key down, on key up. And that's not read only, that's read write. So you can change it anyhow you want by simply changing the document.title attribute in the DOM. Okay? So one nice way to experiment with JavaScript is to take a look at one of these debuggers and then figure out what objects you might want to change and what functions you might want to call within the DOM. Okay, so that's Firebug. And so example 5, let's go back to that. So this is very similar to example 4, except it uses some new techniques. So we have a input tag, text input, name the same thing. And then we have this button, this separate button, which is called, which doesn't have a name, but which calls the tell me function when it's clicked. So example 5.html. If I type something, for example, hello, then I can click on validate. And what will happen when I click on validate? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it'll say, thanks for typing hello. What if I don't type anything in text input? If I leave it empty? Yeah, sorry, you must type something. So what it's doing here is it's validating the input, something very useful when you're trying to validate a field on a form using JavaScript. So we can see here that we have document.getElementById text input value. If that is equals to null, to empty string, then show an alert, okay? So we can see here how the DOM is used. Document.getElementById text input refers to this input box. And then if that dot value, if the value of that is empty, then we display that error message. Yep?
Could you have said on click, tell me, and then pass the, oh no, because it's not this, it's like another thing. Never
mind. Oh, right, yes. Well, actually, no, that's a valid point. You could have used this. If you had said, tell me this, and then if tell me took a variable, and we could have used that variable dot value instead. Oh, actually, no.
Yeah.
You're right.
Wasn't this referring to the button?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, so it would refer to the button in this case. If I said this, it would refer to the button, not the input tag. We could say, tell me this dot form dot inputs brackets 0, which is a fancy way of saying, go to the first element within the form. But that's really complicated when you begin to go into objects and their descendants. It can get a little confusing. So you might want to keep it simple by assigning IDs to each of those inputs. That's a good question. OK, so when I call tell me, it will execute that function. And then, so let's say I did type something. So it goes to the else statement. Document.getElementById mydiv, .innerHTML. So my div is this blank div that I have here, although it's not blank by virtue of saying it's saying this is a blank div. It'll change the innerHTML. So basically, what as I said earlier, it'll change what's between these two open and closed tags. Okay. So innerHTML, by changing that variable, I can change what's inside here. So the current value of innerHTML is, of course, this is a blank div. And by changing that, I've programmatically changed the contents of that div. Okay. And I've changed it to a string, thanks for typing, once I get the value again, and then plus exclamation point. So let's see if this actually works. So hello, validate, thanks for typing hello. Okay. Then if I don't type something, I get an error. Sorry, you must type something. Okay. Any questions? Any questions about this code or anything that we've covered so far? No? Okay. Let's see here. So this isn't very useful because we have to have the user click on validate. And I mean, what's the point of JavaScript if the user has to click on something, right? It would be nice if the JavaScript itself would validate the user's input without them having to click on a button that separately validates them, their code, their input. So I've created example, which one is this? Example 6.html, which is an updated version of the same example. And it says type something and then submit. So you might think of this as a search form or some kind of form that requires validation. So it's a simple submit script, and it just submits to a different page, just as you've been doing with CS50 Finance. But when you click on submit, before it submits, it's going to check the user's input. Okay, and if the user's input is valid, it'll submit, it'll continue submitting. And if it's not valid, it'll stop right there, and no submission will recur. So that's something you can only do with JavaScript, right? And it saves time because the user doesn't have to wait for a response from the server that their input is invalid. It's all done on the client side. Okay. So let's take a look at what the code is like. Example 6.html. We have a form here, form action thanks.html. We can think of that as our PHP page, method equals get, and this critical attribute on submit. On submit, return tell me. So this is a very awkward in syntax here. On submit is another event handler, just like on click and on key up and on key down. It fires when obviously the form submits, okay? And the form submits when the user clicks on the submit button. It also submits when the user hits enter after typing something in the text field. But those are just the two of the ways that a form can be submitted. So when the form is submitted, the tell me function will be fired, the tell me function right up there. Okay, so let's first take a look at tell me and forget about the return for now. Tell me is a function that checks the input as before, as in example 4, 5. If document get element by ID text input of value equals empty string, then alert, sorry, you must type something, and then it returns false. So that's when the validation fails. But when the validation succeeds, then we return true to the caller of the function. Okay? So you've probably guessed by now why there was a return statement here. What this does is that it takes the return value of tell me, which was either true or false, depending on whether the validation succeeded or not. And then we return, so the onSubmit event handler itself returns that same value to what called it, which was basically the browser. Okay, so if tell me returns true, then it'll say, yes, you can continue submitting. And if tell me returns false, then it'll tell the browser, no, stop right there, don't submit. Okay, so this is one instance in which an event handler can have a return value. And onSubmit is one of those. Okay, any questions? This is super useful. Yeah. Method equals get?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was part. Method equals get is part of the XHTML syntax, and there were two methods: method get and method post. And get was the method in which the data being submitted from the form was transmitted via the URL. So for example, www.google.com/search?q=my search term. That was get. And post is when the data is submitted via the HTTP headers. So when it's hidden from the user, but not necessarily encrypted or anything, it's just hidden. It's just two ways of submitting the same data to the server. Okay? Does that answer your question? Or?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me know if it doesn't. Okay. So that's our form right there. And we'll see what it does. So if I don't type something and I hit submit, it says, sorry, you must type something. And then when I click on the OK button, the form doesn't submit. So we can see here that returning false to the onSubmit event handler worked. The web browser isn't submitting it for us. But if we do type something and we do submit, then we submit our form. Okay? So that's how you can do input validation on a form using JavaScript, using the onSubmit event handler and returning something. So in case you're curious, if you do return false here, this will create a form that never submits. Okay? And this is actually very useful using AJAX, because in AJAX, you don't want the, as we'll see later, we don't want the form to submit, but we want it to just go to the JavaScript. Okay, so that's how to do input validation. Any questions? Any questions at all about the first half? No? Okay, so in the second half, after we've taken our tape break, we'll go on to AJAX and how we use that. All right, welcome back. So we're going to talk about AJAX now. AJAX is short for asynchronous JavaScript and XML, although it doesn't necessarily need to involve XML, as we'll see. It allows pages to call home, so it allows pages to get and post to their respective servers using JavaScript. So instead of refreshing the entire page, you can just grab portions of pages, and you can change pages on the fly depending on data that you get from the server. So one example is Gmail. I wasn't checking my email on camera there. I was simply opening this for pedagogical purposes. Anyway, so this is Gmail or Google Apps. And I've opened up Firebug. And as you can see here, Firebug will actually tell you what XML HTTP requests, i.e. what AJAX requests are being made right now. So let's refresh the page. And you'll see here that Gmail is actually very AJAX heavy. Well, these are not all AJAX requests, actually. Some of these are not. Let's see. XHR. So here we have all the AJAX requests. So we see here that as we speak, there are AJAX requests being submitted by the JavaScript that's on this Gmail client. So there are some GET requests. There are POST requests. And presumably these are sort of getting my mail, checking to see if I have new mail, and then also updating some of these. So if you've used Gmail, then you'll notice that if you click on any of the tabs on the left, you'll see that you can actually, instead of the page reloading, the page changes to the new tab immediately, right? So it doesn't take time to load all those emails that you have, all those thousands of messages. It doesn't load all of them. And it just lets you see them by simply clicking on them. And that's because all of these requests have already loaded these emails. So they've already loaded the emails in star, they've loaded all my sent mail, they've loaded the draft mails. So they haven't loaded all the mail, they've just loaded the header, the subject and the to and from and dates, etc. But nevertheless, it's loaded all that information. So instead of me having to go to a page and then wait for the page to load, Google has made it possible for me to just go to a tab and then change the page like so. So that's one example where AJAX is used. And Gmail is really a very good example of what AJAX can do. So that's an example of AJAX in action. So in the olden days, before AJAX, one had to either refresh the entire page or use some trick with iframes, which are inline frames, which you could put in pages. That was just an old trick that you could use. But now you can just simply change the contents of a particular portion of the page using JavaScript and AJAX in particular. Okay, so you can dynamically update content. And as the name suggests, requests are asynchronous. So they run in parallel with other things. So if you started an AJAX request, you don't have to wait for it to come back before doing something else. So you might have heard of threads before. That's when two things run in parallel, and that's what happens with XML HTTP requests. And that also means that there are some headaches that you can get from AJAX because of its asynchronicity. But it's also nice that you can, say, have two AJAX requests spawn at once, and then you can wait for them to return at your leisure. Okay? So that's AJAX. And the core of AJAX is the XML HTTP request class. And that's what makes AJAX happen. It basically creates an interface for you to ask the browser to fetch some page, and then it also creates an interface for those pages to be retrieved from the response. So that's AJAX. So one thing about AJAX is that there are two components always to an AJAX query. Let's see if we can get this working. So there are two parts to an AJAX query. There's the client side, and there's the server side. So from the client side, we create an XML HTTP request. I'll just call it XML HR right now. And then that's using JavaScript. And then that goes to the server, and then that's a GET or POST request. And then what the server will return to the XML HTTP request object with the response. Okay, and this part is implemented using JavaScript, and this part is implemented using any server-side language you want. So, for example, PHP is a good example, and we'll use that today. You can also use ASP or Python or Perl or anything else that supports serving pages to the internet. So those are the two portions that we have to implement. So, for example, with problem set 8, we'll have to implement both the client side, which is Google Maps, what deals with the browser and stuff like that, and also the server side, the PHP side, which grabs all the news items and which grabs all the zip codes, for example. Those are the functions that the PHP side, the server side, would do. Okay, so there's this distinct client and server relationship between AJAX handlers, between AJAX handler, which is an AJAX handler is the server side, and the client is the JavaScript side. Okay. So I said that the request could be GET or POST. We can specify that as an attribute as a property, and then the response can either be XML or it can be JSON. That's not a name. It stands for JavaScript Object Notation, and we'll see that in the next slide. So XML does everyone know what XML is? Everyone pretty comfortable? No? Right, it's like HTML, but you can make up text. That's a great way to summarize it. XML is just basically what implements XHTML. It's just the way you can put tags and put things in it and all sorts of things like that. It's just a way to represent a tree-like data structure in a file, and that's XML. JSON is very similar, but we'll see what that actually is in the next slides. So there are two ways of responding, XML or JSON. Well, actually, you can respond using plain text or anything else if you want, but the two most common are XML and JSON because they're structured data formats that are easy to manipulate using both JavaScript and server-side languages like PHP. Okay, so see what... So can we manipulate using HTML? Yes, you can return HTML as a response and then plug that into, say document.getElementById.innerHTML. If you plug that in, then it'll simply replace that part of the page. That's one way of using AJAX. But I like to think of that as sort of not as good as using structured data formats like XML and JSON. But it's a way to do it, and many people do that too. Okay, so that's the basic map of Ajax. Let's take a look at an example here. We're going to look at example 7.html, which is the BMI, which is the BMI calculator that I made. Let's see. So I talked about the client side and the server side. For simplicity's sake, I'm going to talk about the server side first. So XML handler.php, very simple PHP script, only 9 lines, now 10 lines. What does it do? You can tell me what this does, right? What does it do? You can ignore the XML tags for now. What does it seem to do? It gets some input, $_get. Okay, so we're hopefully now familiar with what $_get is, right? It's the portion of the URL that's after the actual page name itself. Height and weight, those are presumably get variables. And then we're defining a new variable, $BMI equals weight divided by height squared, which is the SI calculation for BMI. And then we're returning some XML, echo BMI. BMI is just a tag that we made up, and that's got the value of the variable that we just created up there in line 6. And then just for getting a kick, we're returning the date as well in line 8 as a date tag. Okay? So this is pretty simple, right? Does everyone get what it does? Any questions about this code? Oh, yeah. Echo is the same as print, but it's actually faster than print, so I prefer echo. And the first line, or the line 2, header, content type, text, XML. This is very important. Instead of returning text HTML, which is the default MIME type, as it's called, so it's like a file extension, but because file extensions don't really matter in the Unix world and on the web, we're saying that this page is XML. And if it's not defined as XML, then your JavaScript might have a difficult time trying to parse it. So always remember that header tag, content type, text, XML. And as with other header tags, it must be put at the top of the page, so before any output has been outputted. So before you call echo or print or leave anything outside of the PHP blocks, you have to call header. Okay. So any questions at all about this? Because I want us all to be very comfortable with this script before we go into the client side. Okay, so why don't I close the PHP tag at the bottom? It's not because I'm lazy. It's actually a useful programming trick that many PHP programmers use. Because, as I said, the header tag requires that you specify header before any output occurs. But let's say that you were including some PHP code in a different file, and then requiring that before the header. Can you see how that works? So before line 1, we'd have some other PHP code that we've included from a different file. And if that file happened to contain a closed PHP block and then had an empty line, that empty line would be counted as output. So header would fail. So I like to leave out the end PHP at the end of the file, which actually eliminates many of those headaches. But good question. You can either... I don't know, your TF might complain or might not. But it's actually very valid, and most big PHP scripts use this. Yep.
What is the R?
The date. So not quite. So the question was, what does the date R mean? Date is a function that returns the current date, that formats the current date in a human-readable form, and R is just is some kind of date representation. I think it just displays the time and the time zone and date and all that. And R is simple to use, so I just like to use R. But, yeah?
And is .date a function within JavaScript? Oh,
no, this is PHP. So this is not a...
PHP, sorry.
Yeah.
It's just a PHP function defined by some
means. Yeah, PHP function, date is a PHP function. You can look it up by going to www.php.net/date. So that's the date function. Remember, the dot is a concatenation in PHP, and plus is a concatenation in JavaScript, but dot is a concatenation in PHP. Yeah, it can be very easy to mess those two up when you're dealing with multiple programming languages at once. Anyway, is everyone okay with the server-side part? Yeah? So that's our XML handler. So presumably we have a client side that sends data to this XML handler on the server, and then it waits for output from the server side, and then does something with that data that we've just output using this script. Okay, so we'll check that this script actually works by directly invoking xmlhandler.php. So height equals something, I don't know, and weight equals okay, so it's working, right? It's outputting an XML file, calculator, BMI, and date and calculator. Yeah. Everyone see why this is the output, and that it's working properly. Yeah. Okay, so that's what it's outputting. That's what the server side handler is outputting. That's what this code is doing. And you notice here that I've supplied height and weight in the get parameters.
When your browser reset, is that just your browser saying that this XML file doesn't appear, have any information, so it automatically prints out PHP?
No, it's actually printing, this is XML that it's printing out.
XML.
Yeah, so Firefox has a useful feature whereby if you give it an XML file without any, without an XSL style sheet, which is a way of pre-printing XML, if you just specify a raw XML file, then it'll print it out nicely for you. And it'll display that ugly gray message at the top. Yeah, so that's just a feature of the browser. Actually, if we view source, we can see that it's actually just one line of code that doesn't look very nice here. That's the XML that's been outputting by the server. Okay, so let's take a look at the client side now. Example 7.html. So now this is much longer than the previous JavaScript examples we've been looking at, but it doesn't necessarily need to be more complicated. So here we have some XHTML. We have a form, which on submit is doCalculate, and then we have two input elements. So let's see what example 7.html actually looks like. So BMI calculator XML version, and there are two text inputs, and then a button saying calculate on server. As you can see, calculate on server is not special at all. It's just a submit button that submits this form. What's special about this form is that it has this onSubmit attribute with doCalculate. Okay, so we'll take a look at doCalculate, which is up here. So function doCalculate from line 10 to 27. This is a function that, very similar to what David's been showing in lecture. So first, there's this try catch block. Try XHR. XHR is a new variable. Is it global or local?
Global,
yeah. It's very important that XHR be global because we're going to use it outside of doCalculate as well, okay? And we'll see why that is, but,
yep. Yeah. Yeah, now that I realized, above function it says var
HXHR. Oh, var XHR equals null, yes. So it's local to the global scope. Actually, good catch. That's actually, it's confusing, but it means that it's actually global because it's outside of a function. Okay, so it's local to that global scope. Yeah. So, well, maybe I should have said XHR equals null instead of var XHR equals null. Okay, so I'm trying XHR equals new XML HTTP request. So I'm creating a new XML HTTP request called XHR. And then if that fails, so try catch, if there's an exception that occurs in new XHR. It'll say XHR equals new ActiveX object Microsoft.xml HTTP. What is this doing? First of all, what does try catch do?
It tries to make it one thing, and if that is a fast failure, it makes it another.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So try catch is an exception handler. It tries something, and then if that fails with a catastrophic error, then it'll go to the catch block. Okay, so you try something and then you catch it. In other languages, it's often called the throw catch. So you throw something and then you catch it. Okay, so you're trying to create a new XML HTTP request, but if that fails, then we try creating a new ActiveX object Microsoft.xml HTTP. So what is this? Why do we have to have a Microsoft? Why do we have to have Microsoft's name in this
script? Because they're your browser.
Yeah, they make web browsers. Well, the thing about Microsoft's XML HTTP request object is that it was the first AJAX that was made for the Outlook web access program. And it was before any of the other web browsers came up with it, and it was before any organizing body standardized AJAX. So Microsoft had its own way for a while with its own ActiveX object before, say, Firefox came along and implemented XML HTTP request. So what we're dealing with here is we're trying to catch old Internet Explorer browsers that still look for ActiveX object, Microsoft.xml HTTP. Okay? So that's just a legacy thing that we're doing here. And hopefully by the end of that block, we've created an XHR object. And these two, the ActiveX object, Microsoft.xml HTTP, and XML HTTP request are identical. They're identically created or defined. So XHR will contain some kind of object that we can hopefully use by the end of that catch block. Okay? And then if XHR is still null, then AJAX null supported by your browser, and then it returns. Okay? Yeah, so what we're dealing with here is something that's very common in web programming, in client-side web programming. Because there are so many old versions of browsers lying around today, not everyone is using the latest version of Microsoft Internet Explorer or Firefox. We have to deal with those old browsers as well. But once we've done that, we can use XHR in a consistent way. Var URL. So here we're defining a URL. Because this is a GET request that we're trying to make, var URL equals xmlhandler.php. Remember, that's the file that we were looking at earlier, the server-side page. And then weight equals document.getElementById weight.value. Everyone's familiar with that now, right? And then plus, and then we're just creating the URL. Okay? And then here's something that's new, line 24, xhr.onReadyStateChange equals myxmlhandler. So what this does is that it tells XML HTTP request to send us an event to notify us when there's a change in the status of the XML HTTP request. Okay? So when there's a change, for example, if the page has started loading, or if the if the request has started loading, or if the request has started to come back, then this event handler is called, this function. So here's where we use defining functions as variables, as we saw earlier. We can define variables to be functions, and that's what we've done here. This is simply a variable, but myxmlhandler is a function that's defined down here. Okay? So what it does is when onReadyStateChange is called, this function will be called. And what this function does is if xhr.readyState equals 4, and that means if everything is ready, if the responses come back, okay, and there are other status numbers which are available either online or in the section notes this week, if XHR ready state is 4, and if XHR status equals 200. So 200 is 200 okay. You're all familiar with 404 not found, 403 access forbidden. 200 is the okay signal, and it means that everything was successful, that we found the page and the server-side handler returned to us. And then I have here debug. Basically what alert.xhr response text does is that it prints out the response of the server verbatim as a message box, and the rest is commented out for now. And that's the onReadyStateChange event handler. So is my XML handler executed right now, or is it executed later? Is it executed in line 24? Is it executed immediately? The answer is no, because it's an event handler. It's just what the browser should do if the XML HTTP request returns. Okay? And then in line 25, we're opening the XML HTTP request. Open get URL, which is the URL that we define up here. And then true, which I think defines the asynchronous Okay. I'm sorry. I don't know what the third argument is. I've forgotten that. Anyway, if you're interested, we can ask a question on the bulletin board and I'll respond. XHR open, and then that opens the request. And then once we've opened that request, we can send that request to the server. Okay? And it's null here because it's a GET request. In a POST request, you would want to send the data in xhr.send. Okay? Any questions about what what this what line 24 and 25 and 26 are doing. Yep.
Even though
you're not sending anything, you have to... Oh, no, you're actually... that's a good question. Line 26, it doesn't appear to be sending anything, but it's actually sending the sending no data to the URL. Okay? And the URL has the data already. Do you get it? So we can actually mix get and... Well, so you can actually mix get and post, because you can have some data in the get query, which is the which is part of the URL, and you can also send data to that URL.
Mm-hmm. Line 26, so you didn't have that.
Right. Well, it won't do anything if you didn't have line 26. It'll just stop there. You've created an XML HTTP request. You've created a request, but you haven't actually done anything with it. That's like writing a form in the grill in the dining hall and then not actually putting it in the basket. Okay. So like you've created an XML HTTP request order, but you haven't given that order to anyone. You've just taken that away. Do you get it? Okay, so the thing here is that you create a request. You create a request to the web server, and then you send that request over to the web server. So it's not you're not directly communicating with the server. You're just creating the order, and then you send that order using the send function. Okay.
Why are you sending null instead of like send like request or like send?
Oh. Okay. So XHR already contains our URL because xhr.open URL. So XHR is an object that already knows what the order is. Okay? We're storing the order itself within XHR. And then xhr.send sends itself to the server. Okay? So it sends no data to the URL. So don't think of it as no data, because the URL itself contains data. It contains height, and it contains weight. Okay? So do you get it, or does everyone else get it as well? If you have any questions, do feel free to come up later on, because this is very important for problem set 8 as well. Yep.
And this is just on the chronology. So you put XHR on ready state change with my XHR HTML handler, and nothing happens right away. And then you send, and then you make the URL XHR open, and you send it with XHR send null.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So at the end of line 26, the response is sent to the server, but we're not waiting around for the server because this is asynchronous. We're waiting for the server to respond, and when the server does respond, the web browser will call my XML handler for us. Okay?
Yeah, but the server would never respond before you hit line 26 XHR
send. Right. The server will never respond before line 26 because line 26 is precisely the order that sends the messenger to the server. The response will never come back before the messenger leaves, right? Any questions? This is very important.
Yeah. Why do you even put XHR ready state change equals my XML handler? Is that just like, why do you put it before line 26?
So line 26 sends this request, the entire request, including which function to call when the browser responds, including that function name to the web browser. So if we had on ready state change after 26, then the web browser would not know what function to execute when the response comes back.
So on ready state change is is something inside XHR?
Yeah, it's inside XHR. It's stored within XHR. Think of it as a pointer within XHR. Yeah? Okay. I'll go over this again in tomorrow's walkthrough because I was very confused when I first came across Ajax as well. And I know this sort of the way in which the response doesn't come back immediately is pretty confusing. Okay. So as we can see here, when I enter something in this BMI calculator, as in line 33, we had this alert XHR response text, which, as I said, returns the plain text version of the response from the server. And as we can see here, it actually does that. It returns the XML. It's a bit small, but it says open calculator, BMI, et cetera, et cetera. That was the XML that we saw earlier when we invoked XML directly, when we invoked the XML handler directly. Okay? So so that's it for a quick introduction to AJAX. We'll be covering problem set 8 tomorrow in walkthrough, which will be from 4:30 to 6 here. Hopefully, we'll be able to cover AJAX in more detail tomorrow, so you're better prepared for problem set 8. And we'll talk about the details of the problem set there, too. So thanks for coming. And if you have any questions, do feel free to talk to me after it's over. And I'll see you tomorrow. And I'm also holding a second walkthrough next Monday after Thanksgiving. So if you want to work on the problem set during Thanksgiving, then come tomorrow. If not, then you can also come on Monday after the Thanksgiving weekend. Okay? So have a great Thanksgiving, and thanks for coming.